clerk will call the docket.
Alfonso Durrell Graves against the Commonwealth of Virginia. Paul M. Wiley, City of Helena. Mark R. Herring, Attorney General. Eugene Murphy, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Appellate.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Paul Wiley. I'm with the law firm Hogan Lovells in Washington, D.C., and I represent Alfonso Graves, the appellant, in this matter. Before I begin, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Both parties agree on the core issue in this case. Mr. Graves received an excessive sentence, and the order under which he is currently incarcerated was void ab initio.
The agreement, of course, is an agreement on the state of the law established by a 2-1 opinion of a court of appeals panel. That doesn't bind us, of course.
Of course not. But the conclusion of that conclusion is compelled by the plain language of the code as well. And the fact that the parties agree, while not binding and does not strip the court of any authority, it does indicate the strength of that conclusion.
Three of the Court of Appeals in the federal circuits have ruled on this exact issue and held that the presence of a mandatory minimum and the presence of a mandatory maximum are two separate issues, upper and lower limits. Is there any authority other than Judge Elder's opinion for the Court of Appeals to support your position?
There is, and it is in the unique nature of the statutory definition of the phrase mandatory minimum in the Code of Virginia, that unlike other statutes, 18.253.1 provides only a fixed term of incarceration, whether it's a first conviction at a lower term, second or subsequent convictions at a higher term. There is not a statutory range of punishment under 53.1, and there has not been since 1976.
Well, you just assume the answer to your question. If it's a fixed term, then it's a mandatory minimum and a mandatory maximum. But that's the question.
The conceiving of this as there being a minimum and a maximum is not, respectfully, is not the correct way to interpret this statute, because of mandatory minimum being a phrase with a specific meaning as opposed to separate words with independent meanings. The statute cannot be read as a minimum, there being a minimum punishment, and thus the question of a maximum punishment, but rather there is an authorized punishment which is described as mandatory minimum punishment.
Then why has the General Assembly, in every instance in which it's had a mandatory minimum sentence, capped the punishment at a maximum if it thought it necessary to do so?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of the question.
There's several citations in footnote 9 to the dissent in Hines that were never addressed by the majority in Hines, and I don't think it was addressed by the briefs here. It appears the General Assembly knows how to say mandatory minimum and knows how to say mandatory maximum. And the cobbling together of inferences from the statutory scheme seems a little strained to me when the General Assembly quite clearly knows how to say what it is you're saying they tried to say but didn't quite say it here.
I don't believe there's any need to cobble together more than or look at more than two statutes, 18.212.1 and 18.253.1. 53.1 provides a term of imprisonment of 3 years for a first conviction. Under the language of 12.1, that is the term of confinement prescribed by law. 53.1 then describes that term of confinement as mandatory minimum punishment. And under 12.1, the phrase mandatory minimum means the punishment must be treated in a certain way. It means that the punishment prescribed by 53.1 must be imposed in its entirety, and no portion of it may be suspended. This is how the sentencing structure has been since 1976. When 53.1 was first enacted in 1975, a first conviction was a Class 6 felony. a second or subsequent conviction was a Class 5 felony. That was operating under minimum and maximum sentencing ranges. In 1976, the General Assembly changed 53.1. For a first conviction, it created one lower fixed term of incarceration, and for a second or subsequent conviction, a separate higher fixed term of incarceration. As this court recognized in Ansel, that was designed to remove the sentencing discretion and replace it with, quote, inflexible penalties. That sentencing structure has not changed and was not changed by the 2004 amendments because it still provides for only those two fixed terms of incarceration described as mandatory minimum punishment as it's defined in 12.1. That's how we get to a clear, there is only one punishment for a first conviction, there is only one punishment for a second or subsequent conviction. That is not a range, there is not a maximum and a minimum, it is a one-shot deal depending on the facts of the case. We believe the plain language of the code is very clear on that, and the statutory and legislative history would inform the court if there were any ambiguity in that. But a close reading of the code using the statutory definition of the term of art, mandatory minimum, in 12.1, informs how that phrase must be read in 53.1 and how the sentence must be imposed.
So the bottom line is that mandatory minimum does mean a mandatory maximum. And the term is fixed, even though it's only fixed at the low end. It seems to me the argument just circles back and repeats itself.
Mandatory minimum means what the General Assembly defined it to mean, and it is not... I recognize that minimum in ordinary usage would imply a maximum, as we use it in everyday conversation.
No, minimum would not imply a maximum. Minimum would imply a minimum, and maximum would imply a maximum.
Correct, but the word minimum in everyday conversation may imply that it is part of something else, but the specific statutory definition here is not setting a floor, but rather describing how a sentencing scheme must be applied or altered by that specific statutorily defined phrase, mandatory minimum. That we believe that the language of the code is very, very clear, and that leads to the question of what the remedy is. As this court recognized in Rawls, a sentence that exceeds that authorized by statute renders the sentencing order void ab initio. The sentencing order is a nullity from the get-go. In this case, there is only one order. There was the sentencing order on all three charges stemming from the same incident.
Let me ask you a question. You say that the sentencing order is made void ab initio. That's not what our cases have said. It said that the sentence is void ab initio.
In Graf-Muller and in Burrell, in Burrell specifically, this court said that an ultra vires provision of a sentencing order rendered the order void ab initio. That it is, Rawls did away with the old regime that a criminal sentencing order could be valid in part and void in part. Rawls specifically addressed that being the old state of the law, that a order would be void only as to the excess. Instead, an order would be voided entirety if it included an ultra vires provision, a provision that exceeded statutory authority.
Yeah, but the thing about it was, just like in Rawls, we stated that it was only the sentence on the use of a firearm charge that was being sent back, and the sentences on the other crimes were to remain as they were.
I went back and I looked at the filings in Rawls, and this court was never presented with the argument that a void ab initio sentencing order would void all of the sentences.
But and I could see how when you have a whole bunch of felonies before the court, and the court's trying to figure out an appropriate disposition and is parceling out how to do that, that maybe if you're lopping off part of a sentence, you need a redo on everything so the court can figure out, do I need to lower it, heighten it, whatever. But here, the court imposed 5 years on the firearm charge that's at issue and suspended two. So we're right back to the three that both sides agree was the appropriate number. I mean, what's the point in those circumstances of sending it back for another big hearing when we're right back to where we started?
There are a few points on that.
No, I know you have the technical argument, void is means void, and so you need a do-over, but aside from that, practically speaking, what's the virtue of...
Well, at first, the two-year sentence, the two-year suspended portion of the sentence, which in this case is still hanging over, and that is certainly part of why the sentence is excessive. But there are other elements of the sentencing in this case that indicate that the crimes were being considered together. As I said, there were three charges all stemming from the same incident. The Commonwealth's narrative during the stipulation all recited one event. The sentencing judge said that he was giving Mr. Graves, quote, considerable credit for cooperating with the Commonwealth, but never indicated how that credit was being quantified or how that quantum of credit was being distributed among the charges. Was it simply he was taking a fairly low end of the range on one charge? Was it lowering from what he thought was the maximum on all of the charges? And it's important to remember that the prison sentence is not the only portion of the sentence here, that there was also a lifetime requirement of good behavior. There is a period of post-release supervision. And while there would be no sentencing discretion on the 53.1 portion of the charge on resentencing, it would be improper for this court to speculate how the sentencing court would redistribute that credit, how it might alter the...
But he could get more time.
We recognize that.
Okay.
That's something I've discussed with the client about the possible effect here. But there is still sentencing discretion to be done when it goes back because of those other elements. That's why we believe that the case law is very clear that the sentencing order is void ab initio and must be vacated in its entirety. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time if there are no further questions.
You have 3 minutes and 52 seconds.
May I please report, Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. In this case, we do consent or agree with the position of the appellant that, in fact, sentence of 5 years with two suspended for the firearms first offense is an excessive sentence, and certainly the excessive portion must be voided. That's been our position for some time. It certainly has been at and from the time of Hines, and I think it has been that way since 1976 without any change affected by 2004 legislation. And I think it's clear that early on, there was no question, it was a fixed penalty. And under 18.2-14, since there was no specification of a class of felony, we look to the statute itself, and it provides for only one penalty. So, of course, as Justice Kelsey has pointed out, the real question here is what did 2004 amendment do?
So the 2004 amendment replaced a fixed term of imprisonment with a mandatory minimum, did it not?
It did indeed, Your Honor.
Well, then why wouldn't it be ordinary for any of us to say what was fixed now has a floor but no ceiling?
Well, I think that if you look at the nature of the bill, don't forget the bill was an omnibus bill treating 2425 statutes.
But I don't get to the nature of the bill until I read the bill. And if I read the word, if I read fixed term, and that's deleted, and replacing it is mandatory minimum, it takes a lot of gymnastics for me personally to come to the conclusion that that means fixed term, still.
Your Honor, respectfully, what our consideration was is what did the legislature intend when it said that? Because it may be somewhat concerning that it has a minimum without a maximum. What was the legislature trying to do at this point? It had a recommendation from the Virginia Crime Commission that there was confusion in the use of the terms mandatory minimum, minimum mandatory, and the suspension of those types of sentences. So it suggested that a number of bills be amended and that the language with respect to the suspension and the mandatory minimum, other than the mandatory minimum language, be taken out of the statute, and all of the language discussing mandatory minimum replaced with the one term, mandatory minimum, and that be defined elsewhere in the statute so that everybody would know what that term meant for all of the sections in the statute.
That but the definition is it simply cannot be suspended. So it is, in fact, a floor. Where is the definition, either in the code in the commission's report or in the statutes, that say that it is also a ceiling?
Your Honor, what I think is important here is that the legislature had no intent to make any substantive changes when it enacted this legislation. If you look at all of the other statutes, you will see that they involve no substantive change other than removing commerce in certain cases, removing the reference to no suspension because that was transferred to 12.1.
I mean, they basically just keyword searched the code.
Yes, sir.
And then just dumped in this particular phrase, which in the main works great, except in this outlier application where it just creates a quirk.
You know, I think what they did was they looked at statutes that had something like this. That is a fixed sentence that had to be served and that could not be suspended. That is, in fact, what the language of 12.1 is, and that's what 53.1 had at that time. I think they've read this as a mandatory minimum, said that this is what's going to have to be served. It is a fixed sentence, but it is in the nature of a mandatory minimum because you have to serve this much and it cannot be suspended. So defining this statute as a mandatory minimum seems to me was merely saying let's join this to the other statutes that have the same effect and proceed with, consider them all part of this one definition of mandatory minimum. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the other statutes were not changed. And to argue that there must have been a substantive change because there was an amendment is clearly not applicable to any of the other sections because nothing was changed for them. And I think that to read into the legislature an intent to make this really significant change, that is the change of the firearms offense, which are imposed every day. Firearms offenses are very, very common in the state and have been fixed since 1976. Seems to me for the legislature to have changed that would have required a great deal more effort on their part to make sure that it was understood that this is, in fact, a difference. And I think the Bullock Court pointed that out, that there was no change of substance. And I would suggest that the intent for the rest of the statute, just to rework the wordage, affects 53.1 to the same extent. Even this court in Duane Brown in 2010 said that this section provides a specific penalty, of course, after the 2004 legislation. But probably most important is the legislature's failure to act since 2004. If this statute really means, the legislature intended this statute to impose the possibility of a life sentence or a sentence of many years beyond the 305, the failure of the courts to adopt that interpretation seems to me certainly would have drawn the legislature's interest and they would have approached the statute to make clear that what they meant with respect to 53.1 was that this now had a wide open maximum, that anything could be imposed. The only limitation was that 50 that you had to impose either the 3 or the 5.
And Mr. Murphy, are you aware of any crime that doesn't have a maximum punishment in Virginia?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I don't know that we have any other fixed penalties. And that, of course, is unique about 53.1. And I think if the uniqueness of that statute were to be changed in 2004, the legislature would have made that clear and would have acted to insist upon a different interpretation after the courts had said, no, it's just the same old fixed penalty that it was before.
But why do you see this as such an anomaly? The Fourth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, they've all addressed exactly this context where there's a mandatory minimum but no mandatory maximum or no ceiling. And except for a 2-1 opinion from the Court of Appeals, I don't know of a single case in the nation, and I've chopped a lot of the trees down in this forest, that says mandatory minimum because of contextualizing and maybe someone would have written it differently if they thought about it, arguments, means that a mandatory minimum is a mandatory maximum. It's just is just counterintuitive, and there's no authority other than the soapbox we're on, which is Hines.
No, you're right. I mean, this is an unusual sentence, and what it has been for a long time. We've had just this particular fixed penalties, and the legislature, I think, to change that would have done it with more clarity. That, in fact, they wouldn't have simply thrown in a mandatory minimum and said, well, figure out what the maximum is.
Counsel, if I recall, this was a two-year effort by the Crime Commission, headed up by then-House Courts Chairman Bob McDonald,
yes, sir,
simply to clean up the code.
That's correct. Exactly.
And it passed the General Assembly, I believe, without significant debate? Or
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. But I do know that it was really an effort to... I know there was a lot of confusion among the Commonwealth attorneys exactly what mandatory minimum meant and which statutes would have and wouldn't, and that this was an intent to ensure that it made real clarity that whenever that language was in a statute, it would be defined under 12.1, give us a common basis of reference for that issue. But, I mean, and there's happened
in the failure. The General, I believe, also participated in that Code Commission, if I recall.
I believe so, Your Honor. But the legislature's failure to act, as the courts in the cases have said, you know, their essence in the statute is, in fact, approval. And, of course, this is the kind of statute that's used every day in the criminal courts. And it seems to me that the legislatures are fully aware of how it's being applied and would have taken some steps to insist that a different interpretation.
There are federal cases, though, that say in the absence of a statutory maximum penalty, the maximum is life, right?
If you define, if there had to be a maximum, yes. I mean, there's no other maximum defined.
Right.
So I assume that that would be the maximum. I think that, again, demonstrates that the legislature would not have simply made that change with the intent to provide no guidance as to what the appropriate maximum would be.
On the issue of what to do if we agree with the Commonwealth and the defendant, why shouldn't this go back if the order itself is void as opposed to just the excess of the sentence, and also if the judge is making a determination with several moving parts, this being one of them, why not send it back for a redo as opposed to just chopping off the excess two-year suspended sentence and be done?
Your Honor, in dealing with this issue of separate sentences in other areas in federal courts, constitutional issues, we have relied upon Woodard and Prieto, which have involved constitutional challenges, and some of the sentences have been found improper. It has been remanded, particularly capital sentence, remanded for resentencing. But the court specifically stated in those cases that each sentence was an individual sentence, that they should be treated individually. The federal courts often talk in terms of federal sentencing packages. But I think here we have the portion of this sentence is void, no question about it. But I don't think we have to find that the sentence for every case is void. And that's what the court did in Hines. Hines sent it back just the direction that the appropriate sentence be imposed. And here, unlike Grafmuller or those other cases where you had discretion left, here there's absolutely nothing for the judge to do.
Right on that. But then if the court is looking at a package of,
I mean, because it's a combined sentencing hearing, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the so-called package was, in this case, was how much active time am I going to give?
Right.
And I think that's in page 61 or so of the appendix. The judge said, well, this provides the statutory minimum, but it also satisfies the total active time. And here, of course, there wouldn't be any change to that. So the judge's intention to impose a certain number of active years of imprisonment is
so based on the transcript that we have before us, we have a pretty good idea that this wouldn't have affected. In other words, if the court had accepted the argument before us, it would have made no difference whatsoever to the ultimate.
Yes, as far as how much active time there would be. Okay. And for those reasons, I would request that the matter be the sentence be vacated and the lower court be directed to enter a sentence of three years on the firearms offense.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiley, you have 3 minutes and 52 seconds.
With all due respect to the position taken by the Commonwealth, the remedy that they have proposed in this case is precisely the procedure that was invalidated in Rawls. Simply lopping off the excessive portion of the sentence remaining with instructions to simply modify the order below and speculating about this court putting its judgment in place of the sentencing court, that is the pre-Rawls regime that this court invalidated in that case. And the Commonwealth suggested remedy would require going back to that pre-Rawls regime. The cases that they cited in the brief, Woodard and Prieto, both are inapposite. Neither dealt with sentences that exceeded the statutory authority. The question in Woodard was whether the judge abused its discretion. It was a direct appeal case with no void order. We would suggest that the most apposite case would be looking at Burrell, a post-Rawls opinion by this court holding that an ultra-virus provision results in the entire sentencing order being void ab initio.
In Burrell, do we send back other charges to be resentenced now, for the defendant to be resentenced?
I believe it was just the one charge that was at issue. I think there may have only been one conviction in Burrell.
Do you know of any instance where this court has sent back multiple sentences because one was invalid?
I know that on remand in Graf-Muller, when this court expanded Rawls, said that the Rawls holding was purposefully broad. When this court's remand in Graf-Muller instructed the court to resentence in a manner consistent with the opinion of the court, and I've checked the records in Hampton, and I would ask the court to take judicial notice that the circuit court interpreted those remand instructions to resentence on all charges. There were three charges in that case, and the circuit court of Hampton did. That was how the remand was interpreted, and while that's not binding on this court, we do think it is persuasive. There have been fairly limited post-Rawls cases. Thankfully, our sentencing courts tend to stay within the statutory bounds, but the Burrell and Graf-Muller decisions, we think, point directly toward vacating in the entirety and resentencing on the whole. As far as the question of the federal cases that you brought up, Justice McClanahan, if we did not have 12.1 in the code, if we did not have a statutory Virginia definition of mandatory minimum, it would be, I think, that would be a great place to look.
What is the definition in a phrase? What is the definition of a statutory minimum?
A mandatory minimum for purposes of imposing punishment upon a person convicted of a crime means that the court shall impose the entire term of confinement prescribed by law.
That's the relevant language. It can't be suspended. Now, literally, how does that have anything to do with how much more you can put on?
Because of the last sentence of 12.1. The last sentence of 12.1 says the court shall not suspend in full or in part any punishment described as mandatory minimum punishment.
So you can't suspend the 3 years. Why does that say you can't put 5 years, suspend two, and not suspend the mandatory minimum, which is exactly what the federal cases say?
Because the words mandatory minimum do not make a fixed term of imprisonment the minimum punishment, which is also mandatory. It makes it a mandatory minimum punishment, words that have a very specific statutory meaning that has been defined by the General Assembly, and that the 2004 amendments conformed the language, the pre-existing sentencing structure of 53.1 to that new, very specific definition. For that reason, we believe that the sentencing order should be vacated in its entirety, and there should be a full resentencing hearing on the amendment.
Mr. Wiley, the court appreciates your pro bono acceptance of representation of Mr. Graves while the matter was on appeal. Thank you very much.
My honor.
Call the next case.